We went to our last session of the year, what's been a, you know, at least from my standpoint, a really fun and successful series. I hope people felt the same way, but it's been a, you know, a lot of new material for us, and for that reason, I think it's been particularly interesting for us. So, thanks for coming, and hope to see you next year when we begin a new series. Today, a terrific way to conclude two extraordinarily distinguished figures, really hard to think, in my view, of two people to get together to discuss this very important issue. Both of them are at the top of their fields and have an extraordinarily broad, to use the term, probably would not apply to my own work, scientific foundation for what they're going to tell us. I'll start. We'll just announce each one one at a time when they speak. They're going to each speak for about 40 minutes. Then we'll take a break, coffee across the hall, and come back for discussion. Well, it gives me very great pleasure to be able to introduce Professor David L. Goodstein, Vice Provost and Professor of Physics and Applied Physics at Caltech, where he's been on the faculty for more than 30 years. In 1995, he was named the Frank J. Galoon Distinguished Teaching and Service Professor. His book, States of Matter, published in 1975 by Prentice Hall, and reissued by Dover Press in 1985, was hailed by Physics Today as the book that launched a new discipline, condensed matter physics. His research in experimental condensed matter physics has dealt with phases and phase transitions, and I don't pretend to understand what this is all about, but I think a few of you might. Dealt with phases and phase transitions in adsorbed two-dimensional matter, ballistic, few of you will, ballistic phonons in solids, superfluidity in liquid helium, and critical point phenomena. His work has led to nearly 200 scientific publications. In recent times, while continuing to teach and conduct research in experimental condensed matter physics, David Goodstein has turned his attention to issues related to science and society. In articles, in speeches, in colloquia, he has address conduct and misconduct in science, the end of exponential growth of the scientific enterprise, and, of course, related to what we're going to be discussing today, issues related to fossil fuel and the climate of planet Earth. The book that came to our attention when we were trying to organize this session, Out of Gas, The End of the Age of Oil, which came out in Norton 2004, he's working a book, he's completed another book about to come out in press at Princeton Press called Matters of Science and Matters of Fraud. Thank you very much, David, for accepting our invitation. Great to have you here.
Okay, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
All right. So the title of my talk today is, by an astounding coincidence, exactly the same as the title of the book that I wrote some years ago. It's called Out of Gas, The End of the Age of Oil. Let's start out with a few myths about energy. First of all, $4 a gallon is too much to pay for gasoline. We used to pay $4 a gallon, and we will pay $4 a gallon again. But $4 a gallon is about $1 a liter. We pay more than that for bottled drinking water. The fact is that at $4 a gallon, gasoline is just about the cheapest liquid you can buy in the United States, and that's a big part of the problem. Oil companies produce oil, at least they say they produce oil. They talk about production, rate of production, and so on. What happens? Okay. Oil companies say they produce oil. In fact, no oil company has ever produced a drop of oil. Oil is produced by the sun and the earth over hundreds of millions of years. The oil companies simply extract it and sell it, and that's why it's so cheap. We must conserve energy, otherwise we'll have an energy crisis. The fact is, the law of conservation of energy is one of the deepest laws in all of physics. Energy is always conserved no matter what we do. We don't have to conserve energy. There is something we want to conserve, though. It's called fuel. When we run out of oil, the marketplace will ensure that it's replaced by something else. We will take a careful look at that in the course of today's discussion. There's enough fossil fuel in the ground to last for hundreds of years. We will look carefully at that as well. Let's talk about energy, a brief history of energy. In the 18th century, there was something called caloric. It was a fluid. It was absolutely conserved. That is to say, it couldn't be created or destroyed. If you took a hot piece of metal and put it into a cold pail of water, you could calculate with precision the temperature at which the two would come to equilibrium by calculating how much caloric would run out of the metal into the water. So it was a precise mathematical theory. But there were those who disagreed, and among those was Count Rumford, or Ben Thompson, who was born in New Hampshire in 1753. He fought on the wrong side in the Revolutionary War and wisely decamped after the war to England and then to Bavaria, where the Count of the Elector of Bavaria named him Count Rumford. Rumford was the name of the town in New Hampshire where he had grown up. He wrote a famous paper about the amount of caloric produced in the boring out of cannon barrels. Cannon barrels produce a great deal of heat. It should not have happened according to the caloric theory, but it did happen. And he even made an attempt to figure out how much mechanical work it was equivalent to a given amount of heat, but he was not successful in that. The law of conservation of energy was discovered some 9 separate times between Count Rumford and his final discovery. When something like that happens, the credit for making the discovery goes not to the person who discovered it first, but to the person who discovered it last, because he discovered it so well that it never had to be discovered again. And his name was James Prescott Joule. In about 1850-something, he announced to the Royal Society of London that the amount of heat required to raise 1 gallon of water by 1 degree Fahrenheit is equivalent to the amount of work required to lift 800 pounds through 1 foot, and that constituted the discovery of the law of conservation of energy. There are various different forms of energy. One form is kinetic energy, that is the energy of motion. A car rolling down the road or a bowling ball rolling down the alley has kinetic energy. But also the atoms and molecules that make up the car or the bowling ball have kinetic energy. They're bouncing around randomly all the time. And the absolute temperature is proportional, directly proportional to the kinetic energy, to the mean kinetic energy of any body. There's also potential energy, gravitational potential energy, like the kind that that he endowed his weights with when he lifted them up above the ground, chemical potential energy, nuclear potential energy, and so on. There's one other form of energy that's important for our discussion today, and that is radiant energy, the form in which energy reaches us from the sun across 93 million miles, 93 million miles of almost nothing at all. In this graph, the vertical axis is intensity, and the horizontal axis shows the frequency, and you can see that there are various different frequencies, radio, infrared, ultraviolet, and so on. I'm sorry that the 2 lowest curves didn't come out on this graph. There's a low curve represents a warm body or a cool body. It peaks somewhere in the infrared and goes to zero before it gets to the visible. That might be the temperature of your own body. You don't glow in the dark because you're just too cool. A somewhat warmer body has a higher curve that peaks more deeply in the infrared. It goes back to zero again. That might be the temperature of an ember in the fireplace, glowing red. The sun has the upper curve, and it peaks very close to the visible. The red, yellow, and blue lines show the visible range of frequencies, and that means that we see all these colors. Our eyes, by no accident at all, evolved to be most sensitive to the colors of the sun as it reflects from the objects near us, and most of the sun looks white because it has all 3 colors in it. So with that, we can speak about the thermal behavior of the sun or the system. The sun has a temperature of about 6,000 kelvins or 6,000 degrees Celsius. It radiates energy uniformly in all directions. 93 million miles away, there is the tiny globe of the Earth. And of the sunlight that falls on the Earth, 30% is reflected and 70% is absorbed. The 30% that's reflected shows up in pictures of the Earth taken from the Moon. This is the Earthrise as seen from the Moon, in the colors of the continents and the seas and so on. The other 70% is absorbed by the Earth and must be re-radiated back out of the space. The Earth receives this light in the form of white, hot light, but it re-radiates it much cooler and deep in the infrared. There's a simple calculation to figure out what temperature the Earth needs to be at to re-radiate the 70% of the sunlight that it absorbs, and it turns out to be 255 kelvins, or minus 18 degrees Celsius, or 0 degrees Fahrenheit. I claim that if that were the real temperature of the Earth, if that were the mean temperature of the Earth, we would not be here. We would never have evolved if the Earth were that cold. Fortunately, it's not the whole story. The Earth's climate is governed by a number of different factors. One of them is the tilted axis. When the Earth is at position A, the axis is tilted towards the sun, and it's summer in the north. 6 months later, when the Earth is at position C, the axis is still pointed in the same direction because the Earth is a gyroscope, but now the south is tilted towards the sun, and it's summer in the south. So the tilted axis governs the seasons. The El Niño cycle is particularly interesting. Water in the Pacific, equatorial Pacific, gets blown by the trade winds towards the Asian subcontinent, where it piles up, creating the monsoon rains that are characteristic of the climate of that part of the world. But once every 3 or 4 years, for reasons that nobody understands, the trade winds slacken, the warm water spreads back out across the Pacific Ocean, causing droughts in Asia and Australia, and storms in North and South America, and a huge perturbation of the world's climate system. The thermohaline flow is very interesting. The water of the North Atlantic flows northward, getting colder as it goes northward, and also getting saltier as by evaporation. Both effects make it denser, and at a point about a few hundred kilometers south of Greenland, it sinks. The water that sinks there will not emerge again for 1,000 years, but it runs back down along the coast of South America, around the coast of South America, out into the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, where it emerges again and flows back to complete the circuit. These flows, or offshoots of these flows, explain the warming of Western North America and the warming of Europe. And if the thermohaline flow were reversed, it could lead to global cooling rather than global warming. And then finally, there's the greenhouse effect, which is by far the most important of all of these effects. The flux of energy from the sun amounts to 343 watts per square meter, averaged over the entire Earth and averaged over an entire year. In pre-industrial times, we had 88% greenhouse effect. That is to say that water vapor, methane, carbon dioxide, and so on in the atmosphere absorbs the infrared radiation that the Earth tries to radiate back out into space and radiates it down towards the Earth, warming the Earth, and radiates it out into space, balancing the books with the incoming radiation. The amount radiated down towards the Earth raises the mean temperature of the Earth from 255 kelvins to 287 kelvins, or 14 degrees Celsius, or 57 degrees Fahrenheit. And at that comfortable temperature, we evolved, climbed down from the trees, and started building steam engines. There are various feedback effects in all of this. For example, the sun warms the poles and causes the polar caps to melt. The melting of the polar caps, the same thing is happening.
I think if you accidentally hit that.
The melting of the polar caps causes it to get warmer in that region, but it also freshens the northern waters. It makes it less salty, and that ultimately could reverse the thermohaline flow and lead to global cooling. So the effects go both ways. These are very complicated things, much too complicated for a mere physicist like me. We like to look at limiting cases. There are two limiting cases that one can look at. One of them is suppose there were no greenhouse gases at all, then the temperature would immediately drop to 255 kelvins. But at that temperature, all the waters of the Earth would freeze, all the oceans would freeze, the Earth would become much shinier than it is, and the temperature would drop much further. The other limiting case is, suppose we had 100% greenhouse effect instead of the 88% greenhouse effect before the Industrial Revolution. If we had 100% greenhouse effect, nobody knows what would happen, but we have a good example to look at. The planet Venus has a runaway greenhouse effect and a surface temperature hotter than molten lead. The same thing could happen to the Earth if we had 100% greenhouse effect. And so the Earth could be a frozen wasteland, or it could be a Venusian inferno, but instead it's this planet-wide Garden of Eden that we have, which we are meddling with at our own risk. This shows the concentration of carbon dioxide in parts per million in the upper curve, the concentration of methane in the atmosphere in parts per billion in the lower curve, and the temperature of the Earth, the mean temperature, in the middle curve, the red curve. The red curve, this goes back over 400,000 years. If you look at the last 10,000 years, even near the number zero on the left-hand side, you see that the Earth's temperature settled down near the warm end of its swings and in the last 10,000 years, and during that period of time, civilization evolved. What this graph cannot show is what happened in the past 200 years. In the past 200 years, the concentration of carbon dioxide has increased from 280 parts per million to 370 parts per million. The concentration of methane in the atmosphere has just about doubled. If the temperature of the Earth were to follow those trends as the temperature of the Earth has followed all previous trends, the results would be catastrophic indeed. We are doing an uncontrolled experiment with the climate of the only planet we have. It is a very foolish thing to be doing. Well, one of the sources of useful energy. Before 1800, we lived on light as it came from the sun. It warmed our surroundings, it fed our animals, and so on. Coal was known to exist, and bits of it were used for space heating. Oil seepages at the Earth were known, and so bits of oil were used for this and that, but nothing very important. There was something called swamp gas, which was analyzed by Alexandre Volta in around 1800 as methane. And so the coal, oil, and natural gas, the three fossil fuels, were known to exist, but very, very little used before 1800. In the 19th century, though, things changed. In 1765, a young mechanic named James Watt was fiddling with a steam engine when he thought of a better way of making steam engines. And Watt's better way of making steam engines has kicked off the Industrial Revolution. By the turn of the century, railroads were running in the land. That had two effects. First of all, it needed coal for fuel for the railroads, but secondly, it provided stable roadbeds over which coal could be delivered for many miles to the cities where it could be used. All of this caused a demand for better illumination. Illumination had not changed since antiquity. Whale oil was used for illumination very widely. But by the middle of the century, the whales were becoming scarce, and something else was needed. Edwin Drake, a retired railroad engineer, drilled the world's first oil well near Titusville, Pennsylvania, in northwestern Pennsylvania, and he struck oil. At first, the oil was used for illumination and lubrication, but in 1861, Nicholas Otto, a German entrepreneur, built the world's first gasoline-burning engine. And soon, oil was in great demand as the fuel. Oil wells were dug all over the world. And the result of that is that we can no longer live on light as it comes from the sun. We are completely and utterly dependent on oil. The problem is that the oil will eventually run out, and then we will be without the mainstay of our civilization. This chart on the left shows where the oil is found, and on the right shows how much there is. You can see that the Middle East has two-thirds of the oil, 10 times as much as in any of the other regions, 10 times as much as in South and Central America, 10 times as much as in Africa, former Soviet Union, North America, and so on. So the only game in town is the Middle East. Nothing else really counts. The reserves, the known reserves, are plotted on the right, and then
2001, you can see that the reserves amounted to 1,000 million barrels, that is to say, a trillion barrels of oil. So it seems that we have plenty of oil. We just need to use it wisely, but that's the wrong way of looking at it. Now, Marion King Hubbert was a geologist who worked for Shell Oil Company. And in 1950, approximately, he had part of the data shown in this graph for the discoveries of U.S. oil fields, which peaked in the 1930s and started coming down after that. And on the basis of this and other information, he predicted that U.S. oil, the oil that could be extracted from the lower 48 United States, would start to decline in 1970. He was almost laughed out of his profession for making such an absurd prediction, but when the time came along, he turned out to be exactly right. The red curve was the kind of curve that he used to predict the amount of oil that could be produced. The black points are the data points for how much oil actually was produced, and you can see that he hit it right on. These graphs show proved oil reserves on the left and the annual oil discoveries on the right. In the proved oil reserves, you can see a big step took place in OPEC, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, in the late 1980s. If you look on the right, you can see that no important discoveries were made in OPEC countries in the late 1980s. Instead, what happened was that OPEC changed its quota rules for how much each country could produce, how much each country could pump, based in part on its own reserves, and the reserves appeared like magic, out of nowhere. And so these reserve numbers are not very dependable. You look on the right, and you can see that the annual oil discoveries peaked around 1960 and have been declining ever since. The annual oil production, or rate of production, is shown in the lower curve, and it crosses over the discovery curve around 1980. Since 1980, we have been producing more oil than we have been discovering. That means that the reserves should be declining, but if you look over at the reserves, the proved oil reserves, you see that they're always increasing, regardless of what happens in the actual fields. So the proved oil reserves are ephemeral, not to be believed. On the other hand, the data on the right-hand graph is the kind of data that Hubbert had for the United States in 1956 when he made his prediction. So we ought to be able to predict what will happen for the entire world based on these data. Here is one prediction. The upper curve is exactly the same curve as you just saw for the production. It's on top of a brown curve, which is their prediction curve. The lower curves are just the partials that add up to the upper curve. And they predict a peak just about now. Nobody knows what will happen. There have been two previous peaks, one in 1973 or 72, when Arab countries took advantage of the declining supplies in the U.S. to embargo oil. Another one in 1979 that coincides with the Iranian Revolution. But the oil production recovered after both of those. But it will not recover after this peak that's shown approximately now. Nobody knows what will happen when that peak occurs, but it will be permanent. It will not be temporary. It will not be dependent on somebody's wishes, but it will be permanent. You have to use some caution in evaluating a prediction like that. There are a number of reasons why predictions turn out to be wrong. For one thing, they used 1.8 trillion barrels of oil for all of the oil that nature had made for us. Looking at the data today, it looks like 2 trillion barrels would be closer to the mark, and that means that the peak is called Hubbert's peak because Hubbert first discovered it for the United States. The peak is a little further off than predicted. New technology is the equivalent of new discovery. New technology makes more oil available, just as new discoveries do. The increase in price, and the price did increase more recently, the increase in price makes more available because you can apply more technology to get more oil out. The reserve numbers are very soft, as we've already seen, and that all of those make any specific prediction undependable. But the basic idea is right. That is to say, the amount of oil available, like any natural resource, starts out at zero, rises exponentially at first, but when it starts to approach the limit of how much oil there is, it slows down, the rate slows down, it turns around and declines back to zero again. That idea is right, and so we will be in trouble not when we pump the last drop of oil, but when we reach the halfway point, when we, when by symmetry, the curve reaches its peak, and the amount of oil on the ground, the amount of oil available starts to decline when the demand for oil is still increasing. So we will be in trouble then and not when we pump the last drop of oil. Ken DeFays, who is an oil man, said, oops, Ken DeFays, who is an oil man, said that he knew that Hubbard had been right and that we had reached the peak in the United States when he read the following line in the San Francisco Chronicle in the spring of 1971. The Texas Railroad Commission announced 100% allowable for next month. You have to be an oil man to understand the significance of that remark. The Texas Railroad Commission was the quaintly named cartel that governed the amount of oil that could be produced by Texas. And when it announced 100% allowable for next month, it was announcing that everybody could pump flat out. The peak had been reached. There was no longer any reason for protecting the oil. I always thought that a similar situation would occur for worldwide oil when Saudi Arabia reached its maximum, because Saudi Arabia has been used for the decade since 1970, has been used to control the world oil supply in exactly the same way the Texas Railroad Commission was controlling the output of Texas. The fact that the oil wells of Saudi Arabia had maxed out was announced on February 24, 2004 in the New York Times in a story called Forecast of Rising Oil Demand Challenges Tired Saudi Fields by Jeff Girth. He goes on to say the country's oil fields now are in decline, prompting industry and government officials to raise serious questions about whether the kingdom will be able to satisfy the world's thirst for oil in coming years. Now, this was a New York Times story, so it was very long. And it was written in a style in which each paragraph contradicts the previous paragraph. That's called balanced reporting. So somewhere further along in the article, it said, some economists are optimistic that if oil prices rise high enough, advanced recovery techniques will be applied, averting supply problems. But it takes it back in the very next paragraph by saying, but privately, some Saudi oil officials are less sanguine, and so on. I don't know whether February 24, 2004 was the day that Hubbard's peak worldwide was reached. It might not be. It might not come for another 5 or 10 years or even 20 years. 20 years is nothing on the scale of human history. One thing we can be sure of is that it will come, because it took hundreds of millions of years for the sun and the earth to create the oil that we have. We've used up roughly half the oil in 100 years, and that's much too fast, and we will reach the peak very soon. Perhaps in 5 years, perhaps in 10 years, perhaps in 20 years, I don't know. Or perhaps it's reached already, I don't know. On the other hand, the New York Times on March 5th, 2007 said, on oil innovations pump new life into old wells. Many oil executives say that peak oil theorists fail to take into account the way that sophisticated technology combined with higher prices makes searching for new oil more affordable, and so on. Typically, oil companies can only produce one barrel every three they find. This represents a tremendous opportunity, and so on. This is all true, but it's irrelevant. That is to say, the oil will run out for the reasons that I just told you, because it took 100 million years or hundreds of millions of years to create, and we've used up half of it in 100 years, and the oil will run out. So who uses oil? Well, there are some 6.5 billion people living on Earth today, most of them reasonably well-fed, as a consequence of something called the Green Revolution, which occurred in the second half of the 20th century. The Green Revolution consists in large part of fertilizing land using petrochemicals, using oil. So I don't think that we could support the 6.5 billion people living today, much less the 10 billion people that are expected by the middle of the century, without oil. Stationary power plants use oil, but in that application it's easily substituted by coal or nuclear power, and so that's not so important. Home heating uses a lot of oil, and lots of people in the East Coast particularly will be in deep trouble if the price of oil skyrockets. But by far the most important use of oil is in transportation. Cars, trucks, planes, ships, and trains all run on oil, and it's very difficult to see what can substitute for the oil. This shows global energy consumption in 1998. It hasn't changed all that much since then. The the scale on the left-hand side is in terawatts. And so for oil, 4.52, for approximately 5 terawatts worth of oil, and half that of gas and coal, and so on. The total is 13 terawatts. The U.S. used 3.3 terawatts, or a quarter of the total. With one-fifth of the world's population, we use a quarter of the world's energy. We are profligate users of energy, something that must stop. 99 quads. The quads is a quadrillion British thermal units. You will not hear that unit used again in this talk. So what about what possible fuels are there? If we run out of oil, what other fuels will there be? The first kind is oil, of course, and light crude oil is the kind that we've always used. But when the light crude oil is gone, it will be heavy oil. Heavy oil is what's left behind in oil fields when the light crude is pumped out. And the more that's used, the heavier it gets. You can always apply advanced technology and get a little bit more oil out of any old oil field, but the more you pump, the heavier it gets and the more difficult it becomes. Natural gas is a very good substitute for oil. It can be liquefied and turned into a liquid fuel, but the Hubbert's peak for natural gas is only 10 or 20 years behind Hubbert's peak for oil, so that's only a temporary solution at best. Shale oil is unborn oil. Oil was born when organic inclusions drifted down into the earth. Oops. Yes. Shale oil consists of oil that never was born. That's to say, the organic inclusion is drifted down in the earth. The interior of the earth is heated by natural radioactivity, so it gets hotter as you go down. If it got just to the right level, it got cooked into oil. If it went too far down, it got overcooked and became natural gas, which may or may not have escaped. If it didn't go down far enough, it became shale oil. So shale oil is uncooked oil, and it can be turned into a useful product by heating it in a retort and strip mining it in a retort, an enormously destructive environmental practice. But it could be done. People who have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in shale oil have sold all their investments because they've decided that it will never be energy positive. It will always be energy negative. It will always take more energy to convert the shale into oil than you get out of the oil in the end. Methane hydrate is known to exist. It's created when methane comes into contact with water, close to the freezing point of water under very high pressure. Nobody knows how much there is, where it is, whether it can be mined successfully. We only know that it exists. And then there's coal. And coal is largely touted as the next substitute for oil. We're told that there are hundreds, maybe thousands of years of use of oil, of coal at the present rate of use. The present rate is not really relevant, but that's not the worst part of the statement is the hundreds and maybe thousands of years. The fact that the estimates range from hundreds to thousands of years over a factor of 10 tells you that nobody has any idea of how much coal there is. The largest deposits are in the United States, but there are large deposits in China and Russia as well. It can be liquefied and used as a substitute for oil, as was done by Germany during the Second World War. They had coal but no oil. But it's the dirty fuel. It comes combined with mercury, arsenic, and sulfur, and various other things. It's the worst fuel possible from the point of view of the greenhouse effect because it's all carbon. Every molecule turns into a molecule of carbon dioxide. You have to increase the rate at which it's mined by a factor of 5 to replace the oil. We saw in a previous graph that we use oil much faster than we use anything else, and so you have to pump it out faster to replace the oil, but the conversion is inefficient, so you have to pump it out even faster and so on. Getting coal at 5 times the rate that it's gotten now is almost unimaginable. But even that doesn't take into account the increasing population of the world, the fact that the poorer parts of the world want a higher standard of living, they want to be more like us, especially China and India, where people are just starting to drive cars today, and the Hubbert's peak effect. That is to say, Hubbert's peak is just as valid for oil as it is for coal, and so we will start running out of coal at some point, probably in this century. So what does the future hold? we will have an oil crisis very soon. I don't know how soon, as I said before, it could be 10 or 20 years, but that's really nothing on the scale of human history. There will be an oil crisis very soon. We or our children or our grandchildren are in for some very difficult times. Fossil fuel will run out by the end of the century, and then that will have unknown consequences for the climate of the planet because we will have burned all that fossil fuel. And if we survive and the planet survives, we have to turn to the only two sources of energy left, which are solar and nuclear. There are dilemmas, social and political, that I can't say very much about, but there are technical costs to that dilemma that I can't say something about. One thing we can do is conservation. Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute has written an article about that. The cars can be made of ultralight, strong materials, so that they go further on a gallon of gasoline. You can all drive hybrids. I drive a hybrid. I don't see why everybody doesn't. They go further on a gallon of gasoline. You can make more efficient buildings and factories. We can get fuel from switchgrass and poplar, and I've added sugarcane to Amory Lovins' list because sugarcane is the one crop that's actually used to substitute for oil in Brazil, but it can't be grown here. And we can make more efficient use of electricity. We can have fee baits where people who drive gas-guzzling cars pay fees, and they're refunded to people who drive more efficient cars and so on. There are technological fixes for the greenhouse effect. For example, one could imagine putting up a parasol at L1. L1 is the Lagrange point one, where an object in orbit would stay in orbit with a one Earth year period, so it would look like a sunspot on the face of the sun, and reduce the solar flux by 2% if you put in up a parasol 1,200 miles or 2,000 kilometers across. But it's probably technically possible to do that. We recently put up a spacecraft at L1 and brought it back, but it's a foolish idea. We've already seen that the flux of sunlight at the Earth doesn't govern the climate. We could be a Venusian inferno or a frozen ice ball with the same flux of sunlight, and instead we have this Garden of Eden. We could sequester the carbon dioxide. That's a good idea, but nobody knows where to put it. That is, say, the amount of carbon dioxide that would have to be sequestered is enormous, and the possible places to put it. Excuse me?
Sequester
means take the carbon dioxide out of the air and put it away somewhere. Is that good enough?
Where do you put it?
Well, that's the question. Where do you put it? That's not so easy. You can pump it into oil and gas wells, but they have a negligible volume altogether, and so that doesn't solve the problem. Solar energy has got to be part of our future. Electric power is solar power because the enormous pressure at the bottom of a reservoir drives a turbine which produces electricity and sends it far away. The water runs out of the turbine and gets evaporated by the sun and rains back into the onto the land and comes back into the reservoir again. So that's renewable energy, but the amount of hydroelectric power that can be all of the sources of hydroelectric have already been used. We can't increase it very much to replace the missing fossil fuels. Wind power is becoming more popular, especially with government support for making windmills. People don't like these big windmills. They're noisy and annoying, but wind will be part of the solution. It's too undependable and too ephemeral to substitute for oil. Biomass is the way we lived until the 20th century. The main problem with biomass is it's inefficient. Only 1 or 2/10 of 1% of the sunlight falling on a given plot of land gets turned into chemical energy by biomass. So biomass will always be used, but it will always be very unimportant. Photovoltaics are the gold standard for solar energy. In order to create 10 terawatts, that's the amount of energy we get from fossil fuels now. In order to create 10 terawatts of energy from photovoltaics, means covering 220,000 square kilometers. All the photovoltaics made up to now probably would cover about 10 square kilometers. So covering 200,000 square kilometers with photovoltaics is an impossible task. On the other hand, the total solar flux that reaches the Earth is 20,000 times those 10 terawatts. So we are awash in solar energy. We have plenty of solar energy, but we have not learned how to use it yet. Scientific American magazine, in December 16, 2007, presented us a grand solar plan for producing some 15 terawatts of energy by the year 2050, if we got cracking immediately to start to produce the energy. Nobody knows whether 2050 is too late or not. It might be much too late to aim to substitute for fossil fuels. But nobody has gotten cracking on building it in any case. So it's an ephemeral hope. Nuclear power has got to be part of the solution. Geothermal power is nuclear. The interior of the Earth is heated by the radioactive decay of nuclear particles. And geothermal energy is used for space heating in various places. It's much harder to use for power. Very few places where a geothermal source, which is close enough to the surface of the Earth, to be used for power. So geothermal will always be part of the solution, but never a very important part. Fission is the kind of nuclear energy we've learned how to use up to now. No fission plants have been built in the United States in the past 15 years. No fission plants have been slaughtered in the United States in the past 30 years. But there are permits being asked for to start fission plants. But to make the 10 terawatts of fossil fuel that we are missing, we take 10,000 gigawatt plants. 10,000 gigawatt is about the biggest plant you can make. And 10,000 plants is just unimaginable. It's just beyond conception. Fusion energy is the kind of energy that takes place in the sun and in the hydrogen bomb. But harnessing it for use is another matter. It's the one alternative energy source into which a lot of money has been pumped. But it's been 25 years away for the past 50 years, and still 25 years away. The energy source of the future is fusion energy, and it always will be. On the other hand, 1 gallon of seawater contains enough deuterium to substitute for 300 gallons of gasoline. So if fusion energy is ever solved, it will actually solve the problem, but it's very, very, very far off. None of those solutions solve the problem of transportation because there won't be any nuclear cars or solar cars anytime soon, but advanced batteries can be made to run cars. Hydrogen can be made. We're told that the hydrogen economy is coming. Our governor has reportedly favors the hydrogen economy, but it takes the equivalent of 6 gallons of gasoline to make enough hydrogen to substitute for 1 gallon of gasoline. So it's a very poor substitute today. In some future time when we have unlimited energy from fusion, for example, hydrogen might be useful, but it's not useful today. And we can make other fuels from hydrogen. Hydrogen can be used for in hydrogen fuel cells, or it can be burned directly as internal combustion engine. Or other fuels can be made from hydrogen. So we understand the basic principles that would make it possible for us to substitute something else for the world we live in today, but we have not started on doing it yet. This is a picture of the United States at 23:15 Eastern Standard Time on the 14th of August 2003, when a great big chunk was taken out of the Northeast by a power line that went out in Ohio. If this much of the United States could be knocked out by one power line in Ohio, we are living in a terribly interdependent society. This figure was probably fake, but it serves to remind us anyway of how interdependent we are. A scientist like me has to make a prediction based on your analysis of the situation. My prediction is civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century when the fuel runs out. I hope my prediction is wrong. I hope that making this talk will help to make it wrong, because some of you will go out and find solutions to these problems, but I'm not entirely optimistic that that will happen. I thought for a long time about what I could do, what I, a neophysicist, could do to help make a contribution to this problem, and I decided that what I could do is to write a book about it, and so I have written a book. And I thank you very much.